You're listening to Talking Architecture, a weekly podcast on architectural narrative, buildings, and the stories they tell. In this season, we're bringing you the Venice Biennial of Architecture, with weekly guests representing national pavilions. In this week's episode, we talk about the South African Pavilion, exploring the architectural representation of social structures through an exhibition titled The Structure of a People. I'm your host, Anthony Youssef, and joining me this week are co-curators Sashaba Mappe, Emmanuel Kambule, and Steven Stein. Sashaba is an architect and senior lecturer at the Witt School of Architecture and Planning, and the director of Africitecture, a parallel practice inspired by indigenous philosophies and worldviews from the past till the present. Emmanuel and Steven are both lecturers at the Tshwane University of Technology. I spoke with the three co-curators about the South African Pavilion and the role of architectural and social structures and their issues. Sashaba, Emmanuel, Stephen, welcome and thank you for joining me today. You are the co-curators of the South African Pavilion at this year's Venice Biennial of Architecture, titled The Structure of a People. This exhibition explores the architectural representation of existing and speculative social structures. I was hoping you could elaborate on the meaning and perhaps the origin behind this title.
Thank you so much for having us. The title, The Structure of a People, is a paraphrase of from a quote, a Frantz Fanon quote in The Wretched of the Earth, where he says, and now I'm going to butcher this paraphrasing, all of this enlightening of consciousness and the changing and growth of our can only be achieved in the structure of a people inside an organization. And this is off the back of his work as a community psychologist or organizational psychoanalyst. He had a lot of insight into the political nature of the psychological and the psychological nature of the political. And so he was basically saying that our agency is obviously heightened in organizational structures, and that if we're really ever going to achieve meaningful change, specifically in the African context, that'll be happening through these structures of peoples, through organizations, institutions, and communities.
I know collaboration was quite important for this particular pavilion. Not only does it feature the three of you as co-curators, but there is quite a bit of work that was done with schools of architecture as well. I'd be curious to know a bit about the process, how you collaborated together, and how the sort of pavilion curatorial premise was developed.
Thanks again. I will also just echo what Stephen said. Thank you for having us here, Anthony. When we were conceiving the project, and just to also give a context, in South Africa, you have to submit a tender. So you tender with the Department of Arts, Sports and Culture to be able to execute the pavilion. And when I was approached, by a team of a company that wanted to do the tender. And I thought I could be the only curator, but I think it defeats our own African perspective on what success is and how we rate and measure success. So this whole concept of collectivism and a collective approach to things. And we insisted that we should be three curators and we should all have an equal say in all that we're going to do, which is probably not the norm, because usually you have one curator that sets up the scene and controls and set up the parameters of any artwork that's exhibited. So we really thought that it would be really important to really bring that message across, that collaboration is at the heart of how an African perspective is to add to creativity and doing things. There were also ongoing conversations, or the people that I approached, we were already having conversations prior to the submission of the tender. For example, I had a meeting with Chaba. I can't remember if it was in the middle of the year of last year or it was earlier, but we were just talking about our interest and our contribution as young. We're all academics, young academics in South Africa. And then this opportunity came, and I thought he's the right fit for this year's Biennale. Then Stephen is my colleague. We work at the same institution at Swan University of Technology, and we've done some work together. And of course, we've had a lot of discussions about what our interests are and what is important to us. And I knew that he will also be the right person to collaborate with.
Yeah, I think one of the core concepts, and it is something that we refer to in the pamphlet for the exhibition, is this idea that architecture convenes us in two ways. The most obvious and primary one is obviously it puts us inside envelopes together. So it identifies us with one another because we're inside together. And the other one is that it convenes us around projects. It basically gives us something to do that makes us make demands on each other, makes us get to know each other, makes us reach out. And ultimately, actually, the work is the thing that produces the community. It's a bit of a cliche to say that architecture makes us and so on. But I think in the literal term, having a project is something, having something to convene around. So it was a fundamental part of the concept right from the beginning, which is why we have this sort of multi-party curatorship, and then also the involvement of more people. So the way that we've organized the exhibition, as you know, and we'll get to it in a moment, is through these zones. But also we made a point of trying to mention our collaborators as much as possible, give them as much agency as possible. This includes architecture schools, people who did weaving, people who did model building, photographers, the actual exhibition installation itself. In each of these projects, there was kind of a meta project of the small community that convened around that part of the project, or that was specifically that kind of established themselves around the project of having to create this appearance, or having to create this structure, or having to create this object.
You did allude to some of the zones that are present or sort of comprise the premise of the exhibition, and I'd like to focus on those a bit. So you have three zones: the past as a laboratory of the future, which sort of alludes to the overall theme of this year's biennial. You have the Council of Non-Human Beings and Political Animals. So the past is laboratory of the future, traces historical links to the architectural representation of social structures as documented in pre-colonial Southern African societies. So I'm wondering if you can give us some examples of some of these documented pre-colonial social structures that are featured in the exhibition.
We selected one, despite the fact that we have different a number of tribes in South Africa, indigenous groups and ethnic groups. So, but we selected the Bokoni people because they don't exist as pure Bokoni group in today's South Africa, but they've infiltrated as part of the Bedi speaking people that are on the northern side of South Africa, particularly in between Limpopo province and Mpumalanga province. And most of the settlement ruins of this particular group is located in Mpumalanga province. So there's actually evidence that has been still being documented by archaeologists of the Bokoni people. So that was the one particular group that we anchored the whole pavilion around. And very fascinating things that we discovered. I mean, I I I've been, my work in academia has touched on this group since, I think, if I'm not mistaken, since 2017, where we worked with the Italian group to document some of these ruins using photogrammetry in Mpumalanga. But I was actually quite shocked that there's also some stones that are in a museum in the Free State province that shows a level of intricacy and understanding of social structures as represented in space or spatial arrangement. And so that is one item that we have in the pavilion. So that, I think for me, that was a revelation. So I think working on this project really helped me to even discover things that were always there, but I wasn't aware of. But yeah, in short, the Bocconi people are the focus of this year's pavilion.
And then the second zone, the Council of Non-Human Beings, contains contemporary drawings by comparison on the topic of animism and architectural practice. I was hoping one of you could sort of explain this concept of animism and how you see it playing a role in architectural practice.
Okay, so that one was my responsibility, Sechabo speaking. So the aim of that exhibition was to draw attention to the kind of philosophies that I had discovered through my research. So what I do as research is that I look at indigenous rock engravings and rock art across Southern Africa with the aim of trying to understand. So a lot of these depictions that people have done in and across Southern Africa, the First Nation people, are depictions of people living in the world and living in the landscape. And what archaeologists have discovered from those images is that people perceived their experience of living in the world as engaging the world as a living being. In my culture, when people perceived just various phenomena in the landscape, like a whirlwind or other things, they would associate those, or they would literally say that that is a living entity, like a snake or some other creature. And so this council, you know, if you can imagine, like any other council, is a group of people who are maybe elected through a democratic process to represent the interests of a constituency, like, you know, us normal people. And this council is a sort of entity that has some sort of powers, and it makes decisions. But these councils, like the South African Council of Architectural Professionals, practitioners, is a council of human beings. We've gone through a lot of, you know, change in South Africa to make those kind of councils or institutions representative of women, of people of color, previously marginalized. Now it's expanding to, you know, people who identify as LGBTQI. You know, all of these processes have gone to really find representation within these councils. But what is missing for me in those councils, if we use indigenous knowledge or if we draw from indigenous knowledge, we would then also include other kinds of persons. So indigenous knowledge doesn't just see human beings as persons, it sees the landscape as a person, it sees rivers as a person, rivers as people, it sees the mountains, animals, et cetera, et cetera. So the Council of Non-Human Beings would then talk about a different kind of institution where we are not only looking at the rights of people, but we're also looking at the rights of land, not the rights to land as a property, but the rights of the land, the rights of the animals, as a much broader idea of a council. And so this is drawing obviously on the indigenous knowledge that has inspired us from Bocconi and the kind of thing that Steve spoke about in terms of Fanon's quote, but expanding that not to just talk about the structure of the people, but also to talk about the structure of the peoples. You see, other peoples, including animals, plants, And obviously, this is all geared towards responding to our issues of climate change and sustainability. And so that exhibition is really dealing with this idea of the broader notion of the council and how can we bring our brothers and sisters, the oceans, the rivers, the animals, into a council that makes decisions in architecture.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely quite a unique perspective on some of the sort of sustainability issues and ecological issues that we're dealing today. And then by contrast, the third zone, political animals, sort of shifts the focus towards South African architectural schools. Can you shed some light on your work with these schools and why you chose to emphasize their organizational and curricular structure?
For me, the architecture schools were an answer to the broader brief of the laboratory of the future. I mean, if we're looking at the future of architecture, certainly the laboratory of the future of the discipline of architecture probably would involve architecture schools where the architects of the future are currently located. The project is a little bit older, and it's actually quite related to the other two zones in terms of relating it to zone one. That rock that Emmanuel was speaking about, those rocks, there are actually an enormous number of them. They have architectural plans on them, basically, and these are from before the European Renaissance and before colonialism. So, I mean, this is sort of up 12th century to 16th, 17th century that these carvings were made. It's estimated. It's not very clearly known because it was a long span. They were done by herdsmen, young men in the fields, as they doodled sort of while they were tending their herds. And they were drawing their social structures as an architecture, effectively. They weren't really drawing these to plan and build buildings. Buildings were a metaphor for them to understand their politics and their hierarchies. So when they fantasized about how they would live in the future or how they would restructure their families or how they would move around, they would actually do this on these rock surfaces in the medium of architectural representation. I think generally there's an idea that architectural representation arrived in Africa from Europe, but I think this is clear evidence that's not quite the case. And then in terms of relating it to Sechaba's work, the idea that the environment is alive is then something one can expand to include organizations. Organizations and institutions, in a way, are alive. They certainly have living components. The people who are inside, locked into those hierarchical structures, animate them and bring them to life. So by sort of trying to place all those two things together, one can then theoretically say, look, you could probably draw sort of bodies for these living creatures that are organizations. And just starting with architecture schools as a way to quite explicitly link it to architecture schools as a laboratory of the future. But theoretically, one could do that with any organization. Sort of carrying on from the introduction of programming and space in the early phases of modernism, that there's this immaterial dimension to architecture that is necessarily political, hierarchical, social, and building on that to create a larger variety of representation, so that when we think about our institutions and our collective agency, we might be able to have different types of access to it. Because at the moment, obviously, it is quite complicated. An organization or institution is a strange and quite a complex thing. So why we call it political animals is because it's a riff on Aristotle's Zoon Politikon, that said that an individual is a political animal or man is a political animal. And this just basically says there might be this other slightly more literal version, which is this strange creature in the form of an organization or institution. So we invited South African architecture schools to make those representations. We consulted with them regularly to keep it kind of in line with the curatorial project. So it wasn't exactly the same as an ordinary competition, but it was still framed as a competition. And in the end, we had six finalists represented in the exhibition in Venice. And three winners, and they each had quite a different take on, I mean, some quite neutral, straightforward, you know, showing chronological processes, this is how you access a university in South Africa. Other ones looking at a recent process and the way that the university has kind of defended itself against transformation, etc.
it seems like architectural structures are as central as social structures to what you're proposing here. But I was hoping to focus on the later. Can you walk us through some examples of the existing social structures that are explored in the exhibition within these three zones?
I will start with political animals, which is just the social structures inherent in those schools. So we try to get students to be quite literal and say, these are the people in this institution. This is how many of them there are. This is the length, the duration of contracts and so on that actually says this is a social structure. Then built as a kind of model with all of its own subjective and atmospheric qualities. With varying degrees of clarity, it's obviously a little bit risky ethically and morally when you start putting real people into architectural representations. They are also made visible and therefore they're made a little bit vulnerable. So we're all trying to find a way to be politically engaged without being, without making people excessively vulnerable.
At the entrance of the pavilion, we have a grass-weaved ring, which in its essence also celebrates the work of a collaborative work that can be done by people who are doing handiwork and crafted work. And the way that element was made, it was made by a group of women in Lesotho that might have never known each other before. And so this idea that Stephen talked about, that people convene around the project, is really exemplified by that item. They are indigenous knowledge system that might have been passed to them by their ancestors and have passed it to the next generation and the next generation. We're hoping that that's now embedded in that artifact that we've presented there. So in a sense, it touches on that, even the networking that happened as a result of working on this project, that maybe we do hope that maybe from there people will now even continue having relationships and social connections just because they came together because of that project. And that happens, I mean, we were not inventing this. These are things that are happening in our context. There are people that convene either around making artwork or any sort of handiwork. And the way that even how our market are organized, you find that people that tend to even work together, if someone is even selling things like vegetables and it's a market for vegetables, there are these social structures that develop around it. So that is what we hope to celebrate. It's not necessarily something unique to South Africa, but maybe it's something that's also available in other contexts. But I think that's an element that we know is very strong in our context, and it's celebrated in that aspect. Then the other one is on Zone 1, we also exhibited a work of Tsi Maila, who photographs the life of people. And his mission is to dignify the life of people in rural areas. And there are certain structures that exist there. So in South Africa, the rural areas, if you are in a rural area, you still have chiefs in what was formerly known as tribal land in the days of apartheid. So we still have that system in place which uses traditional ways of leadership and also of handling community matters. And I guess now it's a hybrid of from a democratic structure, you would have the state working together with those chiefs, and most of them are actually employees of the government. And so there's the work that we've shown there, there's three images that shows homesteads in the rural areas. And again, that's not representative of all of South Africa, so the selection of it was quite was meant to just indicate rather than directly represent everything that happens in South Africa. But what that also celebrates is the process of making indigenous architecture. People also convene around that. And there's a whole layer of social structures that are happening just in the process of building. And historically, you would, if you were building a house, your neighbors will come and assist you in the construction process. And in historical communities, you had larger families. So the process of building a house, you will involve the women, you will involve the children, you'll involve the men, and they all have different roles in just putting up a building. And I have a personal experience of that. I grew up in a rural area. And when we constructed what is known as a beehive-shaped hut, which is also known as the grandmother's house, we and my uncle and I was probably in the early teens then, we went to the forest, collected the wood, and went home, carried that wood and timber lads, and we bended this thing. So I was seeing this whole process because I was part of it. And it was such a collaborative process of just putting together a building and relying on those social structures to actually make it happen. And the same thing applies in maintaining it. So you would know if you're using timber and grass to construct a house, when it falls apart because of the weather and the change of season, it's known that that community will then go together, go and maybe cut the grass and add a new layer on top of that. That this thing, although it was maintenance, but it had a social layer to it on doing that maintenance. If it's the mud, the stick and mud wall, they will then go fetch that particular type of soil that's used to finish up the wall. And then in the process of doing that, there are a lot of social ties that are also being built around there. So I think that zone one is really touching on that, on those indigenous ways of doing things, what I term building together, because in the process of creating or achieving development, it's not a matter of, oh, you've done the work, you've paid a check, then you get out of here, that's it. But that there's new friendships that happen, there's new relationships that are built just because of that work. And in its nature, it aims to do that. And that is what we're hoping to highlight.
The work that I do is connected to where I come from. My home is in what we call the Northern Cape province of South Africa, which is historically known to be the home of the First Nation communities. South Africa was home of the First Nations everywhere, but later during colonization, they kind of concentrated in the Northern Cape province. And so a lot of this heritage exists in my home. And the idea of the landscape being alive is also a socially determined construct, so to speak, because the reason why, for example, when I was growing up, people would say things like, oh, look at the snake, while pointing at the world, at a whirlwind. And then sometimes if a storm passes over your house and it's quite a violent storm, they'll be like, oh, the snake is passing over. And then sometimes if something tragic happens in our community, people will be like, oh, it was the snake. So, and typically if it's something that's connected to, you know, a natural disaster or someone drowns in a river or whatever, they'd say the person is taken by the snake. Now, these are things that people would point at for, you know, your whole childhood. They'd point at one or other scenario or event or situation connected to the landscape and say, it's the snake. So you can imagine your whole childhood, you're told about these things happening in your environment and them being associated to the snake. So what I then discovered through my research was that that was actually a form of priming, because what then would happen when someone becomes a teenager is that you're taken to a place where you've also been told your whole childhood is the dwelling place of the snake. So, you know, as you're growing up, they'll point to a particular mountain and be like, oh, that's where the snake lives. And then, you know, when these events happen, they'll be like, oh, it's the snake. But then at the same time, they say, oh, the snake lives at that mountain. So when you now, it's time for your rites of passage, the very place where you're taken for your initiation is where the snake dwells. So, you know, in my hometown, this place was a cave. And so what that means is that you are, you know, because of the kind of climbing and the fact that this is all part of a cultural and social construct, you are then led to a situation where you have to confront the snake. Now, if you really think about what that means, the cave itself is a dark place, completely pitch black. You can't see anything inside there. And you are meant to go inside there and face the snake. The very thing that you've been told about from childhood, which is causing sometimes devastation, sometimes it brings rain, sometimes it does all sorts of things. And the tool that you're given in order to confront this being is humility. You know, you're told, you go through a process before your initiation starts where they tell you, you know, when you go inside that cave, when you face that snake, you need to be humble. You need to decrease your ego. You need to apply the wisdom and the values that you've been taught when you're walking through that dark cave, when you're confronting that snake. And so the initiate will go inside that space and they will confront whatever they confront. And the idea is if they've gone through that process and are doing it in such a way that they are making reference to the values, the good values that they've learned in the community, they will pass the test and they will come out unscathed by the snake. What does that all mean? It means that this is a cultural system that you could call it a religious or a cultural system that gets a young man or a young woman to learn how to confront the contingent nature of our landscape and our world in general. Because the priming gets them to perceive and name and articulate a condition of life which is change and contingency and, you know, the nature of the world, and especially as it manifests in the landscape, kind of, you know, the way the landscape has its own agency. It does things. You know, I like doing drawings where I show, for instance, someone walking with an umbrella in my architectural drawings, and then I show the umbrella being blown by the wind, you know, kind of going inside out, because that's part of what I've learned through these cultural philosophies in my culture, that the nature of the world, the nature of the environment that we live in, is that it has its own embedded logic or its own embedded agency. And so the initiate, once you come out of that cave, once you've confronted this contingency of life, you are now perceived to be a mature human being. And so for me, what's powerful about that is that we are confronted by the snake once again in the form of climate change, right? And so what it's calling us to do, what the potential of that could be, is that if we learn from indigenous knowledge systems like what I'm presenting, we could then try and understand, what does it mean? What does it actually mean for us to be confronted by climate change? For me, it ultimately means that we need to remember that the planet as a being operates in a particular way, it works in a particular way. If we ignore the processes and the life force and the energy that exists and has pre-existed for millions of years prior to our existence as human beings, which is the wisdom that was acknowledged by First Nation people all over the world. If we acknowledge that, if we recognize that, we could potentially create systems, cities, you know, organizations, policies that realign us with those logics of a pre-existing world or a pre-existing landscape or a pre-existing planet. And so the philosophies that I'm bringing forward here were socially constructed, and that's something that we could probably bring into architecture education and practice to bring this new way of perceiving the land and the planet.
It's clear that some of your personal sort of upbringing or context have influenced some of what you're presenting here. And when representing a country on a national or international forum like this, you sort of need to mitigate between the local and the international. And I find that South Africa's context is always sort of presented in relation to the apartheid. But here it seems that you've proposed to go a bit further back into South Africa's history and focus on sort of its pre-colonial history in order to formulate speculations about the future and be a bit sort of projective. I'd be curious to know, though, how much of South Africa's history with institutionalized racial segregation influenced your proposal for the pavilion.
Apartheid, in my work, is clear that one of its mandates was to change the sort of economic structure of this country in such a way that it benefited those who were in power. And one of the primary ways that was done was by the sort of wide-scale expropriation of land, which previously would have belonged to the indigenous communities, First Nations, and then later other African communities who migrated south. And that was obviously because, you know, by taking all that land, it would mean that those who were here as part of the colonial project would then have control over the economy. And then later, you know, it turned into sort of productive economies and resource extraction. And so key to that, to those processes, was conceiving of the land as a commodity, which were principles and ideas that weren't existing in South Africa in the exact same way prior to colonization. Perceiving the land as a commodity, which is very different from seeing it as a living being, or as an ancestral home, which is how I would say most of indigenous South Africans would have seen the land, connected to their ancestors, and so indirectly connected to a form of kinship. And then also perceiving people, especially the indigenous communities, as labor, and also, you know, not fully human, not deserving of full human rights. So those were key strategic elements that would then, you know, later be used to facilitate the economy of the apartheid regime with cheap labor and access to land freely by those who were in power, so that they could then, you know, support their capitalist ventures, you know, mining and whatever the case may have been. And so ultimately what that meant is that it was important for the apartheid regime to have a specific kind of ontological understanding of the land as a commodity. And also those who come from that land or who were found on that land, the indigenous First Nation people, as also kind of not fully human, so that they can service the industry that, you know, was the plan and desire of the apartheid government, the colonial and then later apartheid regime. So as far as what we're doing here, and in Zone 2, especially in the work that I'm doing, by saying that the land is alive and trying to highlight a different ontological understanding of the land, one is directly responding and challenging the previous regime's understanding of land as dead, inert, and only good for commodification. And so indigenous knowledge in that sense, in that case, is responding to, you know, the apartheid regime's plans of commodification and then, you know, basically enrichment, by introducing this idea as the land being alive and the kinship of land and the rights of land towards a more sustainable way of development.
You know, we were criticized by a prominent South African architect who also presented something at the pavilion at the Biennale. It stung a little bit. You know, the accusation, though subtle, was that we were sort of we were too positive. We weren't showing the country as it really is, because the pavilion is quite hopeful. And we did actually try to create for visitors primarily a positive experience, assuming that people are quite familiar with our history and that the vast majority of what people associate with the Republic is our recent history with a very aggressive racist nationalism after colonialism. So, I mean, it's a long history, but also even the more recent history is quite unpleasant. But I think that what we're doing is fundamentally different. If I may, I wasn't then ready to respond to that critique, but I feel differently about it now. So in terms of sort of propaganda, looking for a politically neutral place from which to construct a society, we obviously did go through quite a long period of neoliberal consumerist propaganda phase of the Rainbow Nation, where everything is really nice and we're all very happy and everybody. And it was important. I mean, I think it got a lot of people, that ideology was useful for people to replace some of their nationalist sentiments and presumably also helped to soothe some of the wounds. But as we now move into what I'm calling sort of the next phase, I think that we, instead of saying, look, we need to harp on describing the problem more accurately to a different problem, which is that one of the places where people run to when they're looking for political neutrality is the natural environment. South Africa is a place of natural beauty and so on, and that's now politically neutral. Or they run into bureaucracy. It's just how things are. Things just move this slowly because those are the process. They're just procedures. It's not personal. It's not political. So instead of us saying, look, let's stop making people part of the landscape, or let's stop making people part of the machinery of our society, we said, well, we can also undermine it the other way around by saying, what if our landscape were also alive? And what if our institutions were also alive? So that you cannot dehumanize people by making them part of the landscape anymore, and you cannot dehumanize people by making them part of political or economic machinery, because those machineries also kind of now will be thought of as agents. So there is quite a sharp critique of the, and it's, I say now in the last, it's Rainbow Nation, but it was even before then, Afrikaner nationalism as an Afrikaans person was enormously based on a kind of mythology of the landscape as well. It was, it wasn't exactly the same as colonialism. So to sort of rebrand those mythologies of the landscape in new terms, I think, is an important part of the next part of this project, so that it isn't any more useful to people who actually would like to dehumanize some sections of our society.
I see that apartheid gave us a material to work with. It actually showed, I mean, what we're living with in South Africa now is we are labeled as the most unequal society in the world. The gap between the poor and the rich. You might have seen some images online that shows an informal settlement which represents poverty and difficulty of mostly African or Black people. And then right next to it, you might see a very fancy, either mostly white suburb, and sometimes even an estate, what we call gated communities in South Africa. One particular one is in Stoepsloot, which sits next to a fancy estate called Steyn City, just right next to it. And the same thing, you'll see the same images in Cape Town and so on and so on. So in the apparatus of apartheid was to use space, or was they were using space to to provide, probably to achieve a level of control of where certain people will be. So the way apartheid worked, for example, they will place even certain tribes in a particular area and say, this area is for the Zulus, and this area is for the Tswanas, and this area is for another group, and for the Indians, for the Coloureds. So that's what apartheid was doing. It was really working. They were actually, they're the one that gave us this material, that you could actually work with space and structure. Somehow, not necessarily that they gave us the idea of what we're doing, but they also provided us material that you can actually use. You can actually make use of space and how you arrange how people are living in space, and bring oppression and bring segregation and separate. But we are at the point now where we need to reverse that to some extent, because we are facing the consequences of that. And I think maybe this project, this and our exhibition probably might bring or provide some sort of hope and insight on how or what we can learn from indigenous people and how they relate to land and things and people, and say, instead of using special structures and space to oppress, you could actually use it to unite, to encourage people to work together and create and still achieve something of value just by working with space and how people organize themselves. So, and that is how I see this, how apartheid influenced this project. I see that they left us something painful that we're still suffering with today, but within that, we're seeing something that we can use to heal the pain that we're still undergoing now.
Thank you for that. And I mean, a lot of what you said is quite specific to the South African context, but I'm wondering how you hope the exhibition will contribute to larger discourses on architectural and social issues, sort of both within the context of the biennial and beyond.
In terms of the pavilion formally, the way that we define those zones and the way that the experience is sort of narrated materially is through 4.5 tons of rope suspended 4.5 meters off the ground, forming these kind of curtains that sort of loosely define the spaces, create a bit of darkness and individual platforms for individual works. The principle of that is an idea of freedom that is architectural. It's still contained together inside a volume, but not so much that you don't have the freedom to move around. This is very acute in the South African condition, where we have these really extreme inherited boundaries that are concretized in the economy, through the law, and then obviously also material in terms of architecture and the construction of our cities. They all embody this. But I think that architecture probably has that kind of problem more broadly as well, which is that containment can be too much, can be excessive on the one end, and be not enough on the other, to not really give people definition. How do you give containment without imprisoning someone, and how do you give freedom without leaving someone entirely vulnerable? So part of the political animals component of the project is to ask other forms of architecture, is there a contribution that architects can make in terms of their disciplinary practice that engages with that directly? And the argument is roughly that programming and space is a politically active form of architectural practice. It doesn't necessarily have to turn into the construction of buildings, but it can. In the context of degrowth and building less, possibly reusing buildings and using space differently, more economically and more equitably, architects probably are going to be looking at a much broader range of practices that don't always necessarily involve constructing buildings for those who already have agency and already have wealth. And part of that might be to really engage with architecture as a form of thinking and architectural representation as a form of communication. And that's a broader conversation. I think that was Patrick Schumacher's complaint. There aren't any buildings. There were buildings. There were plenty of buildings. And architecture isn't only buildings. Hierarchically structuring space is possible to be practiced in all sorts of different kinds of ways. And I think the exhibition as a whole also does that. It shows a lot of variety in terms of the kind of practices that may become commonplace in the near future for architects. The question is, when we aren't making buildings, what are we building? What contribution could we be making then? Because we might spend some of our time not building buildings, not because buildings are over, but because there are a lot of architects now and there are a lot of buildings. So presumably we might be looking at expanding that discipline a bit.
I think in Canada, the work that I'm doing resonates with a lot of stuff that's happening there. I think New Zealand, Australia, other places where there are First Nations, other parts of Africa. I think that, like I mentioned, people like Bruno Latour have been asking these questions about what is our understanding of the world that we live in, and, you know, representation. So, for example, I mentioned that there was a point where we perceived our home, this world we live in, as a planet, as the globe or the global. It has become now the planetary. People have spoken about Gaia. There are different moments in history where different philosophies or outlooks define the way in which we understand the world we live in. So if, the communities in the world who perceive our planet in a different way from what we've ordinarily seen it as, I would argue the dominant understanding of our planet today is still that it is an object. Yes, you know, we've got more people talking about systems, but I think the capitalist world would still prefer to see our planet as largely an object that one can extract from. And if you see it in that sort of way, without articulating a different kind of way of seeing our planet. So, for example, seeing it as systems, interrelating systems, we'll continue going down the road that we're going, you know, where we don't really understand the sort of consequences of the way we see the planet, or the consequences of our extractive economic practices and the things that happen down the line in different parts of the system. So I think what the work that we're doing, that we're presenting, is to say that Indigenous knowledge systems in South Africa and across the world are highlighting that there are maybe different ways we could represent and articulate and understand the planet that we live in. And if we see it as a living being, which is an old idea, which is now becoming a new idea again, something that has pre-existing conditions, which works in a particular way, which has specific thresholds, you know, everything that the people from ecology are saying, which echoes a lot of the things that Indigenous knowledge systems are saying, I think that would have implications for architecture. And so the way we teach architecture, the policies that we make, the bylaws, all of that would then have to really mobilize a practical application of that new perception of seeing the planetary as opposed to seeing the global. So I think there is relevance for other contexts in the kind of thing that we're saying, and resonance with many of the voices that are speaking up nowadays, especially Indigenous communities all over the world.
Yeah, and we see that in Canada here too, with a lot of focus being sort of recentered on Indigenous knowledge and practices. Now, the exhibition is on view as part of the biennial until November 26 of this year. If we can end on some of your perspectives on what you hope visitors will take away after visiting the pavilion.
There's a perception that there's architecture and then there's whatever we call now Indigenous architecture, or African architecture in our context. And the way we talk about it is that is just another thing. It's not architecture. But I do hope that all of these indigenous knowledge systems that have come with our heritage, our architectural heritage, that we begin to see that as architecture, just like Shaba talks about how we see other things with the same rights and with this, and we respect it the same way we respect other human beings, which is a very Afrocentric approach to relationships between people and relationships between things. So I would hope that the world would get that. And the other thing is, we are at a juncture as society where we are realizing that we cannot just take and take and take from this planet. We need to take and give. We need to give back to it in order for this planet to continue existing and sustaining us. We need to take care of what takes care of us. And I think that's something we learn from indigenous architecture. And that's something that I hope that people will take from there. And maybe just lastly, there's a model in Zone 1, which I was responsible for creating. And the message I would hope the world gets is that because it's indigenous architecture, it's mud houses, we should realize that we've missed an opportunity to really explore that kind of work, not just in Africa only, but in many other parts of the world where you still have this indigenous work. I mean, of course, even European architecture came from somewhere and it was developed over the years, and that we need to also develop our indigenous architecture in the context of Africa to bring it to a fore and let it be and make a contribution in contemporary architecture, bring new perspectives of how we should conceive of contemporary architecture. So that's my hope that the world will get from the pavilion. And the idea that we don't have to embrace the future by letting go of the past, that we can use the past to position ourselves and craft our identity and set a course for ourselves as to what we pass on to the next generation. Because I see a building, I like how you describe yourself, Anthony, that you are looking at how buildings and the narrative and stories told around buildings. And I think it's quite an important point that each building that each generation hands over to the next one, within that building, there are stories, there's embedded knowledge system that needs to be told and passed on to the next generation so that they can grapple with it, agree, disagree with it, but they need something to use in order to take that to their next level in the next generation. And that's the message I hope the world will get from our pavilion.
It's meant to operate on three levels. Firstly, it's an aesthetic experience. And for those who have the patience and the time and the effort available, it's an intellectual exercise as well. So they might be able to really gain something and learn something. And then thirdly, for those really deeply engaged, it's a spiritual experience. It's an invitation to a kind of ritual, a ritual of community formation, fear, but also possibility. And those ideas are sort of embedded there. On the most simple level, I hope that people like it. I hope that they find it slightly memorable and interesting. That's really my main hope, is that people kind of like it a little bit.
You know, I think what we haven't really mentioned is that Leslie Loco, who's a Ghanaian Scottish woman, is curating the Biennale. And I think there's a lot of excitement and, you know, more recently, a lot of trauma in relation to this idea of transformation. Because architecture for a very long time has really belonged to a very small demographic of people in terms of who's setting the agenda. And I think, you know, by people coming into our pavilion, And seeing that this is South Africa who's representing ideas that come from a specific group of people who were previously marginalized, you know, and you need to understand that South Africa was one of three African countries that was brought in a country pavilion to the Biennale this year. It shows you that there's so much more that needs to be done in terms of transformation. And, you know, Leslie Loco, for me, represents this real incredible moment in architecture where those who were in the past not given a seat at the table have been given a seat at the table. And so, you know, I'm hoping that by coming to visit the Biennale in general, seeing all the different people of whom many are South Africans participating, and then eventually coming to our pavilion, I'm hoping that a visitor who maybe wasn't sure about their sense of, you know, who maybe didn't really believe that African people can achieve what has been achieved there, maybe that can change their mind, you know, and they can see. I mean, we face a lot of racism all over the world as African people. All of the stereotypes that were there in the past, still many of them remain. So I'm hoping that at the end of the day, people can come here and say, wow, actually, these African people were able to pull this off. Whether they agree that it's the best or not the best Biennale, whether they agree with all the contents or not, I'm hoping that people can acknowledge that, okay, cool. So look, Africans can also achieve things. And we look forward to even greater things to come in the future.
That was Seshaba Mapei, Emmanuel Kambule, and Stephen Stein on the structure of a people, the South African Pavilion at the Venice Biennial of Architecture. Thank you for listening. Join us next week for another episode of Talking Architecture.